From movie set to multiplex, it's the business of film with James Cameron Wilson.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Houston, we have a problem.
Snakes. Why'd it have to be snakes?
One thing I have in common with Indiana Jones is my dislike of snakes. James Cameron Wilson, I'm sure you're all far braver than I am. Tell us, what, pray, is top of the UK box office?
Well, you'd be quite surprised. You'd probably think it would be The Mummy, considering the sort of advertising it's had. But in fact, Wonder Woman is still up there.
Oh, excellent. You'd be quite pleased, wouldn't you?
I'm very pleased, yeah. It dropped just 31% from its very strong opening weekend. Now, if you put that in perspective, that's very impressive when you consider a film like Guy Ritchie's King Arthur dropped 69% in its second weekend. 31% is pretty darn good. And how times have changed, Simon. It only seemed like yesterday that Hollywood was complaining about the plethora of Brits playing all their comic book superheroes. And now we have a superhero movie with a British villain in it. Do you remember British villains?
I do. I mean, that's what you used to specialise in. We go back to sort of things like Die Hard and Alan Rickman. But for a while, they seemed to think all villains spoke with a British accent. Or indeed, in that case, a German accent.
Well, yes. And of course, Wonder Woman herself is played by the Israeli actress Gal Gadot. Which is kind of interesting because Dahlia Lavi died, I think it was a couple of months ago, who was probably the most famous Israeli actress in the world. And now she's replaced spectacularly by Gal Gadot. Directed by Patty Jenkins on a $149 million budget, this is a very good-looking slice of female empowerment set on the island paradise of Themyscira in First World War London, and both in the trenches and behind enemy lines. But there's quite a lot of fun to be had too, as the sexism of London's military personnel is put to shame by Princess Diana's blatant superiority. She can not only kick major ass, but can speak hundreds of languages too.
She probably can't say superiority either, though.
She can pronounce superiority. I'm sure she can. Thank you. And having grown up on a single-sex island, the aforementioned Themyscira, there's the question of what she refers to as reproductive biology. But as the male lead is Chris Pine, needless to say, she comes under his spell and his manhood. Well, as the blue-eyed wonder does tell her, he is above average. Whatever that means. I mean, he's gorgeous, and I'm a bloke, but anyway, it's great fun and good for Patty Jenkins, whose only other film that I can remember was Monster, which was
so different.
What, 14 years ago or something?
Yes, and a very, very different movie. I've heard from a few people that it's rather enjoyable, though one person did say first two-thirds fantastic and then the last third they rather wished that it had been shorter. But they seem to enjoy it. I've heard people recommending it to others, so that clearly is why it's still number one.
Holding strong.
Yeah, so does that mean, therefore, that the Mummy has come in at number two?
It has indeed, yeah. And, well, with multi-franchises being all the rage, such as Marvel Comics' Cinematic Universe, distributed by Walt Disney Pictures, and DC Comics' Extended Universe, distributed by Warner Brothers, such as Wonder Woman, Universal Studios now wants a bit of the action. The irony is that Universal was actually way ahead of the game, and back in the 1940s, before we were born, they were producing films like Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman and House of Frankenstein, mixing and matching their in-house creature brand names.
And even Abbott and Costello meet. They met many people.
Yeah. Well, now the studio, Universal Studios, is launching its so-called Dark Universe series featuring all sorts of monsters and mayhem, with The Mummy being the first installment. It's certainly an audacious attempt, sort of cross-fertilizing its patch with Tom Cruise and Egyptian mythology, the Knights of the Crusade, Islamic terrorists, sandstorms, underwater zombies, and even Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And it's brought bang up to date by kicking the whole thing off with a tunnel boring machine making way for the London Crossrail development.
Oh, wow.
I know. It's quite extraordinary. Thus, a crypt set up for the Knights of the Crusade is stumbled upon and quickly cordoned off by Dr. Jekyll, played by Russell Crowe. And to the astonishment of the workman in charge, he tells him that the train line is being rerouted north of here. Now, anybody who's seen those documentaries about Crossrail will know that could not happen. It's so silly. Anyway, this Monster Mash is the sort of film in which Tom Cruise and his young enough to be his daughter love interest, Annabelle Wallace, run out of the Natural History Museum and into Parliament Square, then into the Shard, in the hope, obviously, that most viewers will never have been to London. Although, as you know, London is the second most visited city on the planet. I think at its best, The Mummy is mildly diverting, if I can be kind for a moment, before succumbing to all that CGI silliness, which I think Wonder Woman also suffers from in the last third. It's neither that much fun, Simon, nor that scary. And it seems a really odd career choice for Tom Cruise. He's playing such an unlikable dolt.
Well, maybe now that he's 55, he has to sort of give up on the Mission Impossible type roles.
Well, he's doing Mission Impossible 6 now.
Oh, is he? Oh, good gracious.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
well, and he's got Top Gun 2, which he's doing next year.
Well, at least in Top Gun 2, you're sitting down.
Well, this is true. I mean, he runs very well. Nobody runs like Tom Cruise on a cinema screen. But before I finish, I have to say that Universal Pictures has tried to raise the dead before with their Van Helsing in 2014. With Hugh Jackman, and of course The Wolfman in 2010 with Benicio del Toro. And already in pre-production, we have Bride of Frankenstein with Javier Bardem, directed by Bill Condon, good director. And they've also got The Invisible Man with Johnny Depp. So they're taking this very seriously. But the opening of The Mummy in the United States was very disappointing indeed, as it was over here. So maybe we won't see more of the same.
Well, how extraordinary. I confess that I did have tickets to see The Mummy, and then when I got word of what people thought of it, I decided I wasn't going to go. So let us move on then from The Mummy, which is number two in the UK box office. What is number three?
Number three is even worse than The Mummy. Oh. And this is a film called Pirates of the Caribbean, Salazar's Revenge, with the aforementioned Javier Bardem, funnily enough, and Johnny Depp, both of whom are in this ludicrously over-the-top, very silly, pantomimic CGI nightmare. I loathe this with a passion. However, I did not loathe it as much as I loathed Baywatch, which I found so offensive. I'm so tired of gross-out comedies. And Dwayne Johnson in Baywatch is good fun. He's got great presence, but I'm very tired of Zac Efron. I see Zac Efron's name on a poster, and I wince. The last four films I've seen Zac Efron in, Dirty Grandpa, maybe being a nadir, are truly dreadful. He's trying to shed that sort of good boy image that he developed in High School Musical. He's even called Mr. High School Musical by The Rock in Baywatch. Ha ha! How meta can we get? Avoid, please. Yes,
it's
there are skimpy.
I mean, as you said last week, such a shame, because he made a film that you and I both liked enormously, me and Orson Welles, not long, I think, after High School Musical 2. And then I'm trying to think what since then I've seen that he's been any good in at all.
No, nothing.
Shame. Such a pity.
Maybe he'll do something with Lars von Trier and surprise us all. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that is Baywatch, which is number four. So, what is number five, James?
Number five, we have a one-off called Take That. Wonderland Live from the O2 2017, which is a live concert celebrating the release of the band's eighth studio album Wonderland. And for the first time ever, apparently, Gary Barlow, Mark Owen and Howard Donald performed in the round at the O2 Arena. It did very well indeed. I think they said this is a record for a concert film, yet it made over £1 million for one performance, which is really pretty impressive.
Which is extraordinary, isn't it?
But, I mean, well, take that, what you can say. And it was 481 cinemas.
Well, it's impressive. I was at the cinema last night, and although it was done incredibly quickly, they were flashing up some of the events you could go and see at the cinema coming up, things linked with opera and linked with theatre. It was all done far too quickly, I thought, because the moment you thought, oh, that looks interesting, it had disappeared and gone on to the next one. But clearly for cinemas, this has been an absolute boon.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
You're listening to The Business of Film on Share Radio. I'm here with James Cameron Wilson. So, James, we've actually looked at the top five in the UK box office last weekend. What is number six?
Number six, we've got a new film, My Cousin Rachel Weisz. It's been quite a week for Rachel Weisz. I was raving about her last week, thanks to her brilliant turn in the film Denial, Mick Jackson's Denial, which has just been released on Blu-ray and DVD, and she now turns up in My Cousin Rachel. Of course, she was also the female lead in the 1999 movie The Mummy. And when I went into the cinema thinking I was going to see my Cousin Rachel, I got terribly confused. I thought, no, this is the new Mummy, which, of course, spawned the sequel, The Mummy Returns, in which she also starred. Neither film was very good, but they were a lot more fun than this week's reboot from Universal Studios. Daphne du Maurier's 1951 novel, My Cousin Rachel, has been adapted for film before, as I'm sure you know. It's been adapted for television, the radio, for the stage, and now arrives in its second big screen incarnation. Not surprisingly, Rachel Ashley is a doozy of a character. As the story's narrator claims, she is radiant, she is good, she is the kindest companion, and he is besotted. She is a good deal besides, as discovered by the narrator's young cousin, the slovenly cavalier and ultimately naive Philip Ashley, played here by Sam Claflin. Previously portrayed on screen by Olivia de Havilland, the de Havilland sisters and Joan Fontaine were very fond on Daphne du Maurier adaptations, yes, as you know.
If not of each other, yes.
Well, yes, I know. Yeah, Joan Fontaine, of course, was in Rebecca. She didn't play Rebecca, as we all know. Anyway, Rachel herself is now given form by Rachel Weisz appropriately in, I thought, was another sterling performance. Under the guidance of Roger Michel, one of my favourite directors, the film begins conventionally enough with a sort of chunk of exposition delivered in voiceover above breathtaking views of Cornwall and Florence and Old Amersham. Actually, Old Amersham comes on later. But there's also the sinister music of Rael Jones, suggesting that this might actually be a gothic thriller disguised as a romantic tragedy. I think a lot of people already know the story, but basically it is Philip Ashley who's absolutely devoted to his cousin. In the book, it's his uncle, but they've made it his cousin in the film. And for his health, the cousin goes to Florence, and there he meets Rachel, and he's completely besotted, marries her, and then he starts sending these sort of rather worrying messages back to Cornwall, and including a plea for help scrawled on the inside of an envelope. And so Philip Ashley, who's obviously not short of a pound or two, rushes over to Florida, only to discover that his uncle is, stroke cousin, is dead, and Rachel has disappeared. Anyway, he gets back to Cornwall and finds that Rachel has arrived in England, so he invites her to stay at his estate. She is a very ambiguous character, and I think this is what's the strength of this film. It's what I would call a cracking good yarn.
James, we have Roger a clip, Fisher. And now might be a good moment to play it.
I was an orphan. Ambrose took me in. He was my cousin, but I loved him like a father.
He died of a tumour on the brain.
Well, I don't believe that.
You know perfectly well his wife drove him to his death.
What are you going to do with her?
Confront her.
Sorry, it doesn't take us much further, that clip, really, but it was the only one I could find. Now, I have seen this film as well. You clearly, I think, like it rather more than me.
I think it was such a relief to go to my local cinema and see somebody not wearing spandex or lycra yes. and something with a pedigree, Simon.
It was.
And I think it was a relief. Yeah. And Rachel Weisz is a terrific... And she's got this balancing act. And the strength of the story is about Rachel Ashley. And I think she carries that off. Sam Claflin, who we've seen a lot of recently... was it Me Before You
he did.
Emilia Clarke, yeah. and then obviously Their Finest. I think he's a very good actor. I don't think he's got enormous range. I don't think he's a great actor by any means. Maybe I will be proved wrong yes. in the future. But for me, this is all about Rachel Weisz, and it looks fantastic.
I agree. She was wonderful, as indeed I thought Holiday Grainger was as well, as the woman who clearly was in love with the central character, but finding herself getting sort of elbowed aside when the Rachel Weisz character turned up. But
and let's not forget Simon Russell Beale is in The Deep Blue Sea with Rachel Weisz.
Yes, as a lawyer, with not a terribly big part, but yes.
I was wondering what he was doing in it, actually.
As commanding as ever. Now, like you, I think Roger Michell is a really interesting director. He's directed Notting Hill, a film not many other people seem to like as much as me, but Peter O'Toole called Venus, that I thought was absolutely fantastic. But this is the first time that he has written a movie, and I'm afraid I thought the script was very, very poor. Irrespective of how much it follows the book or not, as you mentioned, the exposition at the beginning, the exposition I thought was incredibly clunky most of the way through. And the problem was it made Sam Claflin look a pretty dull actor. You say his range isn't very big, but I just felt, you know, the film was more on his shoulders than it was on Rachel Weisz's, and he didn't carry them well. And in fact, I went with a friend who apologised for having suggested the movie. I saw somebody I knew coming out of it. It was very sparsely attended, and they also hadn't really enjoyed it. I mean, it's not absolutely appalling, and if you are looking for something that's a little different from a blockbuster, then, you know, there isn't any spandex in this, as you
point out.
There
is some surprising dialogue, particularly, as you mentioned, Holiday Grainger, where she comes in complaining about the mess the dogs have left. And I thought, what did she just say? I can't believe that in a Daphne du Maurier film. You must remember the line.
Yes, I do. I do.
Yeah, I can't speak it on radio.
It's got a titter in the cinema. I just thought it was just disappointing, and I do wonder if it's because Roger Michell had written it himself and perhaps didn't have the benefit of distance from it. I don't know, but it's a shame. It was.
I just felt it was a good story, well told, extremely well acted by Rachel Weisz.
Yes, she's.
And I don't think it gave itself away at the end.
No, I think the way the plot was constructed towards the end, I think stretch believability a little bit far for me, but no, I wasn't as taken with it as you were. But then I haven't seen as many of these truly atrocious blockbusters as you've had to sit through, and after a while, I guess a film like My Cousin Rachel is like a sorbet cleansing your palate, James.
Indeed.
So that's number six in the charts. What's number seven?
Number seven is Diary of a Wimpy Kid, The Long Haul, the fourth chapter in the cinematic franchise based on the character created by Jeff Kinney. Number eight, we've got Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, not a sequel to Tango and Cash, but a whole new film featuring Sylvester Stallone and Kurt Russell, with Russell now commanding much greater screen time. But then Sly is 70 years old. This, of course, really is Chris Pratt's film, and a highly entertaining piece it is. Number nine, we have Moulin Rouge, part of the Secret Cinema 2017 initiative, where people rush off and see a film projected in an area set up specifically to sort of reflect the ambiance of the movie. Number 10, we've got The Boss Baby, the wise and witty cartoon from Tom McGrath, he who brought us the Madagascar trilogy. And I would like to mention a new film, which is actually at number 14. It's a big release. It's Entertainment One. It's called The Shack. Now, when I saw The Shack back on April the 3rd, I had to sign an embargo contract. But, well, now that the film has been out for a week, I think I can actually talk about it.
Right.
This film Sorry?
No, I'm just slightly surprised. Okay, tell me.
Well, this film is so well-meaning and so serious and so sincere that you just want to slap it and lock it in the basement. It stars Sam Worthington as Mackenzie Phillips, not the actress, a man who was beaten by his alcoholic father in the eponymous shack in the woods when he was growing up. He's now grown up himself, married to fellow Australian Radha Mitchell, and has three children of his own. But then on a camping trip, his youngest daughter goes missing while he's saving his other two children from a canoeing accident. Obviously, Mackenzie is devastated and in the process loses his faith, only to receive a letter in the mail the following winter from God. And she really isn't what he expected. I think to say more would be to be unkind, but quite frankly, this adaptation of the novel by William Paul Young is perhaps too weird, too long, and soporific to gain any new believers.
Mm. Oh, well, James, what a shame. What a shame. And why do you think you sign the embargo? Simply because of she wasn't what he expected?
I don't think they wanted the word to get out. I think they're really worried about this film, and it has got universally panned. Mm. And yet it's so sincere, you just, it's so sad. It is very weird, it is very strange, but maybe if you like seeing Sam
Worthington
running on water...
The phrase universally panned is one we should have used back with The Mummy, which is a universal film.
But too late.
But we can do it next week, James. So I think we want to talk about a DVD release of a film that you rated very highly when it came out.
Yes. Well, this is just out on DVD, and it is what I would call a romantic fantasy for the whole family. And I thought I was actually very moved by it. I was trying to explain this in a nutshell, the fact that it's about a boy who is brought up on Mars.
It's called The Space Between Us.
Did I not say that?
I don't think so, but let's say it again, just in case. Okay,
it's
Space Between Us.
The Space Between Us, starring Gary Oldman and Asa Butterfield. And it's about a boy who grows up on Mars, and he wants to interact with children his own age, and he wants to see the world, obviously. I won't go into why he ends up on Mars. That's not really important. But it was a wonderful way of seeing our own planet through the eyes of a human being who'd never seen it before. Mm. And I think Asa Butterfield is a wonderful young actor. He did a terrific film called X Plus Y. He was in Hugo, directed by Martin Scorsese, and Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. Of course, he came onto the screen with the boy in the striped pyjamas. He is a terrific actor, and he's very gauche, really, isn't he, in this?
Yes.
And
he's now playing slightly younger than he is, isn't he? I mean, he's been around for quite a while, but I think he's 20-ish now, playing presumably rather younger than that. I couldn't quite work out what age.
He was meant to be 16 in the film.
Right.
And I watched it again last night.
And seemed to be that. I thought he's a really good actor. I've liked him ever since I first saw him, and I'm glad he's developing into a good adult actor as well, even though this is a teen role.
Yeah. Anyway, I was terribly moved by this because it was showing a mirror up. I mean, like all good fantasy, the film holds up a magical mirror to the inadequacies of our own reality. And I think there's so much going on in this movie, apart from the fact it looks absolutely amazing. And I've forgotten what a good-looking picture this is. Mm. Were you not moved by it?
Yes, I was. I thought it was sweet. There were... don't know. I suppose there were moments when I wasn't quite as diverted as I'd hoped I would be. But yes, it looks good. But then it's made by Peter Chelsom, who's one of my favourite directors, with one or two exceptions. I think I've liked everything he's done, and they've always looked wonderful. And he manages to get across a sense of wonder, I think, in movies.
Which is very rare these days.
Absolutely. And I know he's rather upset that the film didn't get more push at the box office, than he felt critics didn't really understand it. So it's wonderful, James, that you are trying to persuade people they should go and see it. It's called The Space Between Us. It's now out on home video, strongly recommended by James Cameron Wilson. James, as ever, thank you very much indeed. We shall talk next week, and we'll try and get in that universally I can't remember, universally panned
yes,
joke.
The Mummy.
Yes, all right. Bye for now.
My mother thanks you. My father thanks you. My sister thanks you. And I thank you.
I'll get you, my pretty. And your little dog, too.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.